pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that spent the better part of 50 years lying in the dirt, getting shot at on purpose, and how a handful of stubborn people brought her all the way back to the sky. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar. And today we're doing a restoration spotlight on a big silver lady named Doc. Now, most of you know there's exactly one B-29 Superfortress that's been flying the airshow circuit for decades. That's Fifi, the commemorative Air Force ship, and God bless her. But for a long, long time, Fifi was the only one flyable Superfortress left on the whole planet, out of nearly 4,000 that Boeing and its partners cranked out during the war. Today there are two. And the second one, the one that took the longest, hardest road home, is Doc. Let me back up and set the scene, because you can't understand the restoration until you understand where she came from. The B-29 was the most complicated, most expensive weapons program of the entire Second World War. More expensive than the atomic bomb, if you can believe that. Pressurized cabin, remote-controlled gun turrets, and engine, the Wright R-3350, that was so hot-tempered it had a nasty habit of catching fire in the air and killing crews before it ever saw combat. It was a leap, a generation ahead of the B-17 and the B-24 in every way that mattered. Doc rolled out of the Boeing plant in Wichita, Kansas in March of 1945. Hang on to that word Wichita, because it's going to matter a great deal by the end of this story. Now here's where it gets interesting. She came off the line right at the tail end of the war, so she never dropped a bomb in anger. Instead, she became a trainer and then a radar calibration ship, and she was assigned to a squadron of B-29s that some clerk with a sense of humor had named after the Seven Dwarfs. Sleepy, grumpy, happy, the whole gang from the Snow White picture, and this airplane, this one right here, got painted up with a little cartoon of the bespectacled dwarf in the doctor's coat. They named her Doc. Before I go any further, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it, and every coin tells a story. Now I've got a soft spot for anything that honors the moment you crossed a line and became a little more of a pilot than you were the day before. That's what these are. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. Every coin tells a story. And speaking of stories, let's get back to Doc, because hers takes a dark turn by the mid-1950s. The Superfortress was obsolete, the jets had arrived, and the Air Force did what the Air Force does with old airframes. They flew a whole fleet of them out to the high desert of California, out to the Naval Air Weapons Station at China Lake, and they lined them up in the sand as targets. Picture that for a second. These magnificent machines, the pride of American industry, dragged out into the Mojave and staked to the ground so that pilots could practice putting rockets and cannon fire into them. Doc sat out there in the sun and the wind for decades. The paint burned off, the aluminum went dull and gray, rattlesnakes moved into the wheel wells. Practice bombs and gunfire chewed up the ships around her. She took her share of hits. The desert doesn't preserve an airplane so much as it slowly mummifies one. Back when Avigas was cheap and airspace was free, nobody thought twice about it. There were thousands of these things. Who's going to miss a few dozen out in the scrub? And there she stayed, forgotten, for something like 42 years. Now enter a fellow named Tony Mazzolini. Tony was an aviation man, a veteran, and he'd gotten it into his head that he wanted to find a B-29 to save. He'd heard rumors about the graveyard at China Lake, and in 1987 he went out into that desert to see for himself. What he found was a row of corpses, but one of them, one airframe, was in better shape than the rest. She'd been sitting far enough from the main target line that she hadn't been blown to pieces. The fuselage was straight, the wings were there, and when Tony crawled up inside and started poking around, he found a little painted dwarf and the name Doc. It took him more than 10 years just to get her out. 10 years. You don't just back a truck up to a Navy bombing range and drive off with a piece of Cold War hardware. There was paperwork, there were negotiations, there was the small matter of the airplane being government property sitting on an active weapons testing range. But Tony was a patient man and a persistent one, and finally, in 1998, they were allowed to recover her. They had to partially take her apart right there in the sand, pull the wings, load the pieces onto trucks, and the question was, where does she go? Well, where do you send a Wichita-built airplane that needs the deepest, most complete restoration anybody's ever attempted on a bomber? You send her home. They trucked Doc back to Wichita, Kansas, back to the very city where Boeing workers had riveted her together 53 years earlier. And that, my friends, is where the real story begins. Because getting an airplane off a bombing range is hard. Making her fly again is damn near impossible. Let me paint you a picture of what restoration actually means on a machine like this. This is not sanding down a cub and shooting some fresh dope on the fabric. The B-29 is 141,000 parts, it is miles of wiring. It is four of the most maintenance-hungry radial engines ever built. And Doc had spent half a century as target practice in a salt and sand sandblaster of a desert. The corrosion alone was heartbreaking. When the volunteers opened her up, they found aluminum eaten thin as a potato chip in places. Control cables seized solid. Rubber gone to powder. Instruments full of grit. And here's the thing that makes a restorer's blood run cold. When you need a part for a superfortress, you can't call up the parts counter. Boeing doesn't make them anymore. The tooling was scrapped generations ago. There's no bin at the back of the hangar, so the volunteers, and this is the part that gets me every time, the volunteers made them. By hand, they found original 1940s blueprints. They taught themselves the old sheet metal techniques. They formed new skins, fabricated brackets, rebuilt entire assemblies from scratch to the original specifications. When they couldn't find a good part, they became the factory. And who were these people? That's the heart of it. A lot of them were old Boeing hands, retirees. Men and women who had actually built B-29s in that same city during the war, or worked the Boeing line in the decades after. Now they were in their 70s and 80s, coming back into a hangar to build the airplane of their youth one more time. Grandfathers teaching teenagers how to buck a rivet, that skill, that muscle memory from the assembly line of 1944, passed hand to hand to a new generation right there on the shop floor. They called themselves Doc's Friends, and they worked for free. Tens of thousands of volunteer hours. Some estimates put it north of 300,000 hours of labor before it was done, and it was slow. Lord, it was slow. The project started in the late 90s, and it stalled out more than once. Money ran dry. The airplane sat, again half-finished, under a roof this time, but going nowhere. There were years when it looked like Doc would become another museum, static display, at best, a hangar queen that never turned a prop. But the crew wouldn't let her die twice. They got the engines overhauled, and I want you to think about what that means. Four Wright R-3350s, the duplex Cyclone, 18 cylinders each, turbocharged, temperamental as a cat in a bathtub. These are the engines that used to burn down on brand new bombers in 1944. Getting one running is an art. Getting four running and running reliably enough to trust with human lives over a city is something close to a miracle. There's a smell to a big radio when it first lights off. Oil smoke and raw avgas and hot metal. The whole airplane shakes. The prop blades swing through and catch one cylinder, then a few, then a coughing, banging, blue smoke roar as all 18 jugs come alive and settle into that deep, lumpy idle that no jet on Earth will ever match. When Doc's engines ran for the first time, grown men who'd spent 20 years on that airplane stood there with tears running down their faces. Now here's where it gets interesting, and where it gets tense, because running on the ramp is one thing, flying is another. The FAA does not hand out a fresh airworthiness certificate on a one-off, 70-year-old, hand-restored bomber, just because you ask nicely. There were inspections, ground runs, high-speed taxi tests down the runway, faster and faster, feeling for the moment the controls come alive, without ever leaving the ground. Every system checked and rechecked. The margin for error on a first flight of a unique airframe is exactly zero. If something they built by hand from a 1940s drawing was wrong, they'd find out at 140 miles an hour with people on board. The first flight came on July 17, 2016, 61 years after she was hauled into the desert to be shot at. 18 years after Tony Mussolini dragged her out of it. Doc lifted off the runway at Wichita, wheels in the wells, four big radials pulling her up into the same Kansas sky she'd first climbed into in 1945. The crew on the ground said you could hear that sound rolling across the whole airport, that unmistakable superfortress drone. And for the first time in more than half a century, there were two airworthy B-29s in the world again. Doc had come all the way back from a boneyard target to a flying, breathing piece of living history. And that's really the point of all of this, isn't it? Why does it matter that a bunch of retirees spent decades and a fortune to make one old bomber fly when you could park her in a museum, dust her off, and let a million people file past? Here's why. A static airplane is a photograph. A flying airplane is alive. When Doc taxis up to the crowd line at an air show now, with those props ticking over and the ground trembling, a kid can stand there and feel in his chest what his great-grandfather knew. The men who flew these things were 19, 20 years old, freezing at 30,000 feet, watching those engines for the first wisp of fire. You cannot get that from a plaque. You get it from the sound and the smoke and the sheer physical presence of a machine that still does the thing it was built to do. The people who restore these warbirds aren't just fixing airplanes. They're keeping a memory warm enough that the rest of us can touch it, and Doc is proof that no matter how far gone an airplane looks, no matter how many years she's spent rotting in a desert with holes shot in her, the right people with enough stubbornness and love can bring her home. I'll grump all day about a lot of things in modern aviation, but when I see what Doc's friends did in that hangar in Wichita, I've got nothing but hope. As long as there are people willing to buck rivets for free on a Saturday to save a piece of history, this whole thing we love is going to be just fine. My thanks to Doc's friends and the folks at the B-29 Dock Hangar and Education Center in Wichita, who keep her flying and tell this story better than I can, and to the recovery crews and historians who documented every step of the long road out of China Lake. You can find more about today's tale over at RadioHangar.com. She was a target once. Now she's a queen. Not a bad second act for an old girl from Kansas. This is Tail Dragger. Keep your eyes on the sky. And if you ever hear four big radials coming, stop what you're doing and look up. That's Doc saying hello.